This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Maybe I'm ambitious, but I want to start the countdown clock, the COVID countdown clock, to the time when we can say that the worst is over. I think we're there. But what comes next? How soon before we can say, okay, the vaccination is not only rolling out, but it's working? And then comes, well, we can start to ease the restrictions that we're all facing. And then comes the distancing and the masks beyond our bubble circle. Let's try and get some answers to when life is going to return to normal. Dr. Paul Romeliotis is the guy with the answers, hopefully. Medical Officer of Health, CEO of Eastern Ontario Health Unit. Good morning, Dr. Paul.
Good morning. I don't have that magic crystal ball.
No, but I'm thinking, because I know they're saying, what is it, Canada Day? They want everybody in this province to have their first shot. Is that not the marker?
Yeah, I think so. I think it is. I think that, in this province, the marker would be end of June,
nice,
that you have the shot in the first arms. Now, that doesn't, you know, protect everybody, and, mm-hmm. A second shot is needed, but that goes a long way. As a matter of fact, we've been meeting provincially with some of my colleagues at the public health measures table, and we're actually looking at what point, what are the markers, what are the indicators that, okay, we're starting to vaccinate, how many do we have to vaccinate before we start, loosening up the restrictions, returning to some progressive semblance of normal.
Yep.
When do we do that?
And?
I am optimistic that we're looking at around the same time, around the summer. I've always said that this summer, I think, would be a much different summer than the last summer. One of the things that sort of is putting a wrench in all this is these VOCs, mm-hmm. these variants of concern. However, I do believe that if we, continue what we're doing, and as you can see, we're starting to see the numbers go up a bit in Ottawa and in our area as well. Let's, not let this get out of control so we can then start revving up. Now, I was very optimistic over the weekend. On Saturday, we actually had a meeting with the general and the ministry, and we were given our allocation numbers for the next month, and they're much higher than they have been in the last couple of months.
More doses than you expect.
Oh yes,
nice.
Oh, yes.
Significantly, so, it sounds like.
So to me, it allows us to really start planning, for those mass immunization clinics and moving forward, so we can then start getting into phase two. Phase two would be, looking at individuals less than 80, looking at essential workers, looking at people with chronic medical conditions and those type of things. And that's a big percentage of the population. So certainly what we're trying to do is we're trying to rush those high-risk individuals, like get the 60 and above, the others who have medical conditions or because of their work are higher risk. Let's get them done as soon as possible. As soon as we do that, then we'll be able to do, everybody else who wants to be vaccinated. So I do, I'm optimistic with the timelines. Now, in our area, I know I've been asked this a couple of times, when do I think we'll be done? I would estimate sometime by the end of May, that we'd have done a first shot in our area. But you gotta understand that we're barely 225,000 people in my area, right? Mm-hmm. So, it has to do with the numbers. But I do know that all the health units were quite excited over the weekend because we started getting, a glimpse of what the numbers are to come. So it won't be a matter of not having enough vaccine, and it won't be a matter of us not being able to plan accordingly. It'll be a matter of how quickly we can roll it out. And we've been preparing for this. There's a variety of ways that we're going to be doing it. Mass immunization clinics, fixed clinics, drive-through clinics, mobile clinics. We'll be doing all those. But I do believe that as we vaccinate all the vulnerable population, particularly the people that are being hospitalized and are dying, as we do those, there'll be much less of a panic or much less of a worry about those individuals, and we'll be able to open up. So I think that this summer will be a much different summer than last summer. It'll be normal.
No. Yeah, I mean, yeah. What that means, you can get together with friends at a barbecue?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to wear a mask?
Yes, you probably should.
Okay.
Because we don't understand yet how the virus is protected. In most situations, I got to tell you, if you have vaccinated you against measles,
yeah,
you're vaccinated, you're good. Even if you're even exposed to it, you're not going to get an infection. We don't know this virus long enough. We don't know this vaccine long enough to say that. But in most situations, once you're vaccinated, you should not be able to get any infection. You should be, and any infection should be very mild. Whether or not you shed it is the question.
Mm-hmm.
So because we're not sure, there, we have to be a bit more careful. But I know that the numbers of people that can gather will go up. I know that, you know, public events will increase in terms of, you know, outdoor events, indoor events. They're not going to be, you know, like, we're not going to go to, you know, filling up, you know, the CTC. You know, it's not going to be that quickly, but it'll go up to 100, 200, 500. It'll go up that way. Where we'll be in June or July will, again, depend on the number of that people have been vaccinated, but also it will depend on also the, don't forget, we have the other factor that's the negative factor that is, the, you know, the numbers of cases. So hopefully we'll see that this is like plateau, and as we vaccinate more people, we'll try to see a leveling off of the cases, even if they're VOCs, going down and increasing the numbers of shots in arms.
G7 countries are looking at vaccination passports, even here in Canada, which could essentially open the border to people from the United States, for example, or other countries in the G7 who want to come visit as a tourist this summer. Is that something you can get around and say, you know, August 1st, we see the borders open and tourism back in Ottawa?
Hard to say. Hard to say. I know that there's, you know, two opinions. One say, you know, that will cause a lot of stress and a lot of inequities. And others would say that it's a good idea. I know that some countries are going to be doing that. I don't know if Canada is going to follow suit. But again, there's a logic behind it. But is it applicable and is it equitable? Those are the questions.
Dr. Paul Romeliotis, appreciate your time as always, sir.
No problem.
It's 10 o'clock on the other side. What is going on with approval numbers or lack thereof for Erin O'Toole? Try and get to the bottom of that right after the news. Next, News Talk 580 CFR.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
The Conservative Party of Canada has an important convention coming up in 2 weeks, and it may be leader Erin O'Toole's most important speech of his leadership, if not potentially of his career, because, well, his numbers are quickly souring. I mean, the guy didn't even get a bump. You know, normally there's a honeymoon period right after a new leader. Whether it's his own doing or maybe the pandemic, the circumstances, who knows? But it didn't happen for him, unfortunately. He didn't get the opportunity to even prove himself because the numbers just went below Andrew Scheer's, if you can believe it. So is he about to sink the Conservative Party of Canada? And is he really the sole person to bear the blame here? Let's find out what Philippe J. Fournier thinks. Of course, founder of 338canada.com. He's a polling expert and a Maclean's columnist, and he writes about this in the current Maclean's. Good morning, Philippe. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Leslie.
All right, let's begin first and foremost. Is he the only person that bears the blame here, or is it just because he's the leader, therefore you have to own it?
Well, there's a bit of both, I would say, because, of course, it's not his fault that Derek Sloan decided to empower the social conservative wing of the party and start to put all these questions about the sanitation measures in this country. And so that's not Erin O'Toole's fault. However, yes, you're the leader, so you're the face of the party for now. And so, as you said, the speech that he will make in 2 weeks to his party, will he speak to the party hopefuls, or will he speak to all Canadians? This is the question that we're wondering, and we'll see whether he tries to get out of this jam, because the numbers right now are really not good. For those who haven't seen it, I published numbers from Abacus Data yesterday that shows that only 62% of Conservative voters actually have a positive impression of Erin O'Toole. And for the Liberals in Justin Trudeau, it's 80%, and same thing for Jagmeet Singh. So even Conservatives are not that keen on Mr. O'Toole right now.
Okay, let's throw in Derek Sloan. He's part of the reason why he isn't getting the kind of numbers he'd like, he being, in this case, Mr. O'Toole. Is there a bit of revenge here and sabotage potentially? Because he, even though he's no longer a Conservative, he will not be attending the convention, from what I understand. He's got his disciples, pun intended, to basically go in there and say, make trouble and bring up the abortion question again.
I really do not know how these social conservatives think they can help their cause or their party by doing this. I really cannot explain it, but all I can say, Leslie, is that I analyze the numbers. And we have plenty of data on this, if the social conservative wing of the Conservative Party takes over we're going to have a decade of Liberal majority in front of us, and that's not going to be good for the Conservative Party. It's not going to be good for Canadians and our democracy.
Yeah.
The numbers that we have, if let's say we have a real social conservative as the face of the CPC, the NDP would probably surpass them for second place.
I always say to my friends who are conservative strategists, I say to them, why would you even bother courting this group that's going to tear you down? And they're afraid that Maxime Bernier will be, you know, the NDP of the right and pull enough votes away that they can't win. And I'm like, we're not there yet.
Well, and you are correct. We're not there yet. And I think let's admit it, there's a huge steps between Maxime Bernier's People's Party and the Conservative Party. I know some people say they're close, but in reality, when you look at the votership, the voters of this Conservative Party, most of them are moderate. But there's that 15 to 18% of social conservatives who are very vocal and who, if they decide to bail on the Conservative Party, they have no path to re-election. They have no path to winning the election. So they have to keep them in check and also please them just enough to secure their vote. It's a very hard balancing act for Jerry O'Toole. It's, Justin Trudeau is dealing right now with a united party. Only 5% of Liberal voters have a negative impression of Justin Trudeau. 80% have a positive impression. And so Justin Trudeau, for all his faults, has full grasp of his own party. And I'm not sure that's the case for every O'Toole.
Well, let me ask this question, because there are a lot of people, and I see them, maybe that's a vocal minority, but I see a lot of criticism for the handling of the rollout of the vaccines. I mean, go through the list. There's enough criticism for Justin Trudeau, although it may all be a moot point once the vaccines get in our arms in the next couple of months. That being said, if the pandemic weren't held today, in other words, if this wasn't even an issue, would Aaron O'Toole find himself buried like this, or would he be able to dig himself out and sort of silence the social conservatives? Because let's face it, everybody wants to be in power, and when you're in the lead, you'll maybe ride the coattails even if you are social conservatives.
That's true. That's absolutely true. But the thing is, unfortunately, this is a hypothetical that we cannot verify. Mm-hmm. When the pandemic began, the Liberals and the conservatives, the leaderless conservatives, were tied in the polls, and it was a very close race. Of course, let's not forget, a year and a half ago, the Conservatives did win the popular vote in Canada, but they ran the score up in Western Canada, especially Alberta, to win. The point I'm trying to make in the article is, aside from the favorability in numbers, when you look at the voting intentions throughout the country, right now the Conservatives are behind Andrew Scheer's 2019 defeat. They haven't gained anything in Quebec. They haven't gained anything in Ontario. They're still lagging by 30 points in Atlantic Canada, and they even lost some support in British Columbia since the pandemic began. Right now in BC is a three-way race, whereas Andrew Scheer won British Columbia by, I think it was 8 points in 2019.
Wow.
So if you start losing some of your Western support and still haven't made any gains in the East, there's no path to victory.
So in times of crisis, traditionally, people don't want to change government. They're kind of like, better the devil we know, however you want to phrase it, better we keep, the ship steady for now and we'll worry about it next election. Could that be playing into it here, and then just the disappointment of Mr. O'Toole just, adding to the Liberals' support?
I would say that's a fair argument. In 2020, there were three provincial elections, and all three, the incumbents were reelected with strong majorities. There's an election right now in Newfoundland. I know it's been very quiet of late, but it looks like, if the data is correct, it looks like the Liberals will go from a minority to a majority there in the provincial legislature. So there's a fair point to be made there. But then again, when you see the NDP, the federal NDP right now, pulling just above 20%, in normal times, this could be, if you're telling me the NDP is at 21-22%, my reflex would be the Liberals are in trouble. But that's not the case.
Yeah.
And so it looks like maybe there's some orange-blue voters in this country that could hand the Liberals a majority if they switch their votes from the Conservatives to the NDP.
20%, is that broadband levels? Is that Layton levels?
Yes.
What is that? It is, huh?
Absolutely. Layton actually went to, I think it was a shade on the 30% in 2011, but usually the cruising speed of the NDP is around 15-16%. When you see them at 19, 20, 21%, Leger had them at 23% last week. And so, in normal times, this would mean the Liberals are in trouble, but not this time.
Can the Bloc do anything in Quebec to block a majority government?
No. No, they cannot. Because right now, if you look at everything is possible. But in reality, when you look at the numbers, even by giving a normal polling error in favor of the Bloc, they would win the most seats that are right now for the Conservatives. So François Blanchet and Erin O'Toole are fighting for the same demographics in Quebec. The Liberals are doing well in downtown Quebec City, in Montreal, the Outaouais region, the eastern townships. Those seats, most of them, are not in danger. And so, François Blanchet is a bigger obstacle to Erin O'Toole than he is to Justin Trudeau.
Okay, we haven't talked the Wii scandal. We haven't talked the military scandal. It's not even registering in the polling?
We don't have any data yet. I think it's too early. Okay. And also, I think this may be an example of the Ottawa bubble that people... it's in the news, but I think many Canadians do not care about this story. Should they? Perhaps, yes, absolutely. But we haven't seen movement in the numbers because of those stories.
We say this, that the Liberals are the best at strategy, and it's just because they've been in government for so long. Is that why that they're able to do this? These in any other time, what we've witnessed from the federal Liberals today would be enough to bring them down, but they may get a majority.
It's possible, but just look in your lifetime and my lifetime. Yeah. Usually the party that captures the center of the electorate mm-hmm. wins. And so this is why Erin O'Toole decided, after his I'm a True Blue campaign, he decided to aim for the center. And that was the right strategy from the Conservative leader. Will voters believe him? Because, of course, we have the receipts. We saw the Conservative leadership campaign. So I'm not sure if it's going to work, but whoever can capture the center will probably win the election. And right now, the Liberals are wide in the spectrum.
And the last laugh goes to Peter McKay. Right? Because, there would have brought the party back to the middle, and then we would see a much closer race.
It's possible. Yeah. It's possible. The emptiness in a breakaway, right?
Yeah. I love that. Philippe, it's always a pleasure to prick your brain. Appreciate it.
Have a great day, Leslie.
You too. Philippe J. Fournier, you can read everything we just talked about in his latest McLean's column, this website. It's brilliant if you're a Politico and if you like to get the very latest. 338canada.com. He is the expert in this country when it comes to these things. 10:19, we'll take a quick break. News Talk 580 CFRA.
You're listening to Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
We always forget about people that we rely on the most in this country in many ways, the farmers. Last summer, let's just say that it's one to forget for the Canada's farmers. Pandemic made it almost impossible on so many levels. In particular, how to hire enough workers to harvest their crops. Remember, they had made all the exceptions to get the workers in here, Mexicans, for example, in particular. And then what happened at some of those farms because of the conditions of being too close together. And this was early on in the pandemic. I don't know if they really ever recovered. Now they've listed on those eligible for COVID vaccines, in phase two, farmers. So will that get agricultural workers on the list to the point where we can actually have a great summer? Let's bring in Ken Forth, president of the Foreign Agriculture Resource Management Service. That's a mouthful. Ken, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you guys do at the Foreign Agriculture Resource Management Service?
We simply do is the logistics for getting workers from foreign countries. In a nutshell, real quick, the farmer puts an order in. It's called an LMIA. Okay. It describes which country, what dates, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
To Service Canada. And Service Canada, when they approve it, they send it. The farmer sends it to us. Actually, they instruct Service Canada to send it directly to us, and then we arrange all the movement of those workers with all the ministries of labor in those supply countries. It's simpler because there's one body doing it rather than 1,400 farmers doing it, and it works real well. And we get the people here. We arrange the air flights. Right now, we have to arrange charter flights, so we actually rent airplanes.
Wow. I've actually flown back. I flew back from Mexico City, me and hundreds of migrant workers from Mexico who are coming to work on Canadian farms. And they are proud to do so.
Darn right they are, because it does a couple of things. First of all, there's a lot of people out there that, not so much in this country, maybe, but there's a lot of people like myself who actually like doing manual labor. Some of us actually like to do that. Like construction workers like to do manual
labor.
Of course. That's what they like to do. They like to work with their hands. These guys are the same. These guys also see opportunity here to enhance their lifestyle back home if they come here for 6 months.
Yeah, it changes their families and lives, and that's the most important to these guys.
We've seen a huge traveling through the Caribbean and Mexico.
Yeah.
You can tell the ones that either work in Canada or the United States. You can see it.
Okay, are things good for this year?
Well, it's the same thing as last year. We still have this pandemic to deal with. It looks like the light might be at the end of the tunnel. Like a year ago right now, you and I wouldn't even know what the heck this virus was. We all kind of learned about it and scared us to death probably from then till Christmas. And then they started to come out with vaccines, and the vaccines, they've been moving without a doubt. They seem to have moved out slowly, but when something good always comes, it always seems too slow, no matter how fast it is. And now it looks like the light's getting more at the end of the tunnel, more all the time. I think we have 4 vaccines now, which is a positive thing. And maybe we can start to immunize more of this country. I mean, I got 2 daughters that live basically 10,000 miles apart on different sides of the globe, and they've both been immunized already. One's in California, one's in Ireland. So why aren't we?
Well, to the question of Mexico, because I have some friends who live there who are expats, and they've been vaccinated as well. Why aren't we? Good question, Ken. That being said, what about the migrant workers? Are they going to get on the plane pre-vaccination, or do they have to follow the rules like everybody else, prove that you've got a negative test, and ultimately, you'll quarantine when you get here?
Yes, they have to prove they have a negative test. They get tested again at our airport at Pearson, and then they have to isolate for 14 days. And there's a test involved in that at the 10-day point when they're in isolation.
Are we going to be giving our doses of vaccines to them?
I hope so.
Okay.
I hope so. They are on the list. The government has made the decision that they're part of the second wave of the list from a bunch of reasons, I guess. I mean, the government makes those decisions. First of all, farm workers cannot work at home.
Yeah,
like you can't stay at home and go on your computer. Like I have staff at farms that work at home because they're able to. They don't have to have their hands on the office. But a farm worker, if he's picking tomatoes as an example, still has to pick tomatoes. You can't do it from the computer.
And they're in cramped quarters just because that's what bunkies are like, right? When they're working, they come here.
Yeah, but not as cramped as you might think. There's a lot of rules and regulations around it. There has been for years. And they were without a doubt enhanced in the last year.
Yeah,
it must be
say.
Pointed out that our Ministry of Labor in Ontario and the Integrity Branch of Service Canada, who inspected those places all through last year, found the majority of them to be compliant to the new rules that they put in place for social distancing and all those kind of things.
Noted.
So there's a lot of stuff been put in place, I can tell you. You walk into our bunkhouse, there's more signs and posters around than I've ever seen before, but they're a requirement, and it tells them what to do and what not to do. So it's evolved over time.
Was there
last year? We didn't have a clue.
Any leftover damage from last year because we couldn't necessarily do the crops the way we wanted because of all the pandemic issues faced that they have to?
Oh, there was absolutely, because like as an example, last year when this pandemic was announced, right about now, the government suspended the program for 2 weeks. And when they finally reinstated it, Jamaica was ready, but Mexico had stopped processing things because they didn't know if they were even going to send anybody at all.
So we had a shortage.
They just didn't decide for 2 more weeks. So there was a whole bunch of Mexican workers that couldn't get here early enough to do the asparagus crop. The asparagus crop was in peril last year, without a doubt, and others.
So if things go well, is there going to be some collateral damage from last year that they still have to, that we could pay for ultimately?
Well, I think some of the collateral damage, not to mention the workers, but collateral damages, we've seen some farmers go away.
Yeah.
I've got one that I was at his farm the other day, and he said, I said, well, you had 40 guys last year. What are you doing this year? He says, we're growing corn and soybeans. How do you feel about that? He said, the pain's gone.
So are they retiring or are they losing their farms?
Well, not really. He's 50.
Oh.
So there's no way you got time. I'm quite a bit older than that. You don't retire at that when you're a farmer.
No kidding.
But the stress level is high.
Yeah.
The stress level, first of all, you don't want anybody to be sick. Second of all, you don't want anybody to be sick on your farm because these workers, in a lot of cases, man, I'm telling you this, are just like family to us. So if they get sick, it's like your family being sick.
Yeah.
And then it's the economic thing, the business side of it. If you can't harvest your crops, like that it's not a manufacturing firm where you can shut the plant down for 2 weeks and then go back and still put the parts together. If you have to shut the farm down for 2 weeks, there's a lot of crop that will never be harvested.
Well, you made your case, you have messaged loud and clear why this is a priority, not only for them, but for Canada going forward. Appreciate it, Ken.
It's kind of what you said before. They do live together and all that, and we agree with them vaccinating. We agree with them vaccinating everybody, for gosh sakes.
Exactly. Wouldn't that be nice? We have too much one day. Thank you, Ken. Appreciate it.
Have a good day.
Bringing us up to speed on that. President, Foreign Agriculture Resource Management Service. We'll take a break on the other side. Get ready. Gas prices remain high, but for how long? We'll find out. Next, News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Have you filled up lately? I had to take a double take when I looked at my bill when I was filling up on the weekend. I made it into triple digits. First time in a long time I paid more than $100. I thought, boy, was I traveling on fumes? No. The gas prices have gone up big time. It costs you more to fill up the gas tank in our great city this weekend, any point over the last 20 months. What's going on here? And most importantly, when's it going to come down? Let's bring in Dan McTagg, President, Canadians for Affordable Energy. Good morning, sir.
Good to be here, Leslie.
You know, I feel badly because every time I talk to you, it's always, you know, what's going on with gas prices? And I remember when you were the MP and you were like, I think I'm going to get out of this political business and get into, well, what you're doing now. Remember those days, Dan?
Yeah, I remember one evening saying it was going to go up 12 cents a liter, and you put me on the spot and said, you better be right, or during the middle of a federal election in 2008. And I'll tell you, I was quaking in my boots and said I'd never do that again, Leslie.
Yeah, and then here we are. What was the price back then? Do you remember? So many years ago. It was like a decade ago.
Yeah, that actually popped. It was due to Hurricane Ike, and it went from $1.28 to $1.40 a liter in that range, and it was during the federal election, so it was even stranger at that time. But we're nowhere near there, and thankfully so. But hey, you know, it's all over the map right now, and we don't know exactly how these prices are going to how they're going to go over the next couple of months. But sneaking suspicion is that get used to higher prices.
Okay, so let's start with the price right now in Ottawa versus where you are. You're in Toronto, right?
I'm in Toronto, which is only a penny higher, and that's because your wholesale price is about half a cent less in Ottawa than it is in Toronto.
Okay, so what are we paying right now?
$126.9 in Toronto. That's at the highest stations. Of course, there's always a few stations that will shave their retail margins, so they'll be down to $118. Same for Ottawa. You'll see $117.9 all the way to $125.9. Anyone below that, of course, is selling below cost, and you have to wonder if there's other products they're selling where they're making up the difference.
Do we have to worry about it in collusion, or is there a reason to explain this?
No, it's pretty transparent. I mean, they'd be the first one to call these guys off, but they're simply price takers. Saudi Arabia has driven oil from $52 a barrel all the way to $66 on Friday. Oil prices, by the way, West Texas Intermediate, Brent, have hit prices we haven't seen since November of 2018. It's hard to say that because it's so long ago, and although gas prices are back to here in Ottawa to where they were in July of 2019, there's still a little bit of movement that could see prices go even higher. But in the short term, I think this is it. In fact, if I'm looking correctly at the tea leaves, by Wednesday, Leslie, we'll see an average, wait for it, big deal, 1 cent a liter drop, but perhaps heading in the right direction, at least for the next couple of weeks until the federal carbon tax is scheduled for yet another increase on April Fool's Day.
Aha. Uh-huh. I was going to say, how do you feel about that? But I think I know after that comment.
Oh, yeah. Well, 8.84 cents a liter plus 13, that's 10 cents a liter just on carbon taxes. I hope you're getting rebated.
Well, I was going to say, don't we get it all back? Isn't that the line we hear?
Yeah, well, three greatest lies won't hurt a bit.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
So what does that mean in terms of, I mean, are we going to be paying this through the summer? Potentially?
We are. It looks like, unless there's some kind of significant drop in demand again, maybe a third wave, let's hope that doesn't happen. I'm not seeing anything that would suggest prices backing off. We also shift from winter to summer gasoline on the 15th of April. And there's that little thing called the Line 5 Enbridge pipeline, which the state of Michigan wants to close. If that happens, all bets are off because all the fuel here in Ottawa comes from Montreal. Some might come from Toronto. But everything from Sarnia all the way out to the East Coast will be affected adversely, with about half of our gasoline supplies completely cut off for a period of time. And, of course, that will mean not just higher prices, if it happens to come to pass on May the 13th, so what, 60 days from now, we're looking at a scenario that would play out that would also see yellow tape at a lot of gas stations right across the province, right across much of eastern Canada.
Like a shortage of gas?
Shortage, definitely a shortage. Look, it's Line 5 has been providing oil, sweet oil, light oil from Alberta since 1953. It goes into our refineries, the three in Sarnia, the one in Nanticoke off Lake Erie, and of course through a connection to Line 9, which provides Montreal's Suncor plant almost half of its oil. If all of those things are interrupted for any extended period of time, rail and ships and tanker trucks driving from Alberta aren't going to be able to make up the difference. So we would definitely be in a shortage situation, and it would probably move prices up rather dramatically. Worst case scenario, 90 cents a liter.
Increase of 90%. With $2, technically?
Nine, yeah, so it'd be at $2 a liter.
Wow. Have we ever had
that? Yeah, it's that serious. And it's, I know that some of us are a little ambivalent about pipelines, and it's easy to debate them until you actually need them. So propane, gasoline, diesel, and most importantly, think of, for instance, Toronto International Airport, Pearson Airport, would be completely shut down. 100% of its fuel comes from Line 5's oil, which is processed in Sarnia and turned into aviation fuel there.
There's nothing the federal government can do. If the supply's not coming, they don't have the supply to do it, right?
No. Well, the federal government's going to have to get involved in rationing and whatnot. But unfortunately, I think they're a little late to the game. They only started talking about this maybe in the past few weeks. Leslie, this has been a problem going to my days at Gas Buddy when I was working, doing a lot of emergency management for them during outages, where various states would come to me and say, listen, it'd be great if your federal and provincial governments would actually wake up. This threat by Michigan to cut off your pipeline is very serious. And if it happens to be, and it does come to pass, then we're all in deep trouble. And, of course, those who want the transition to the Great Reset and the Resilient Recovery are going to get a really good taste of that mid-May as we get into summer driving.
Give us the background. Why the threat?
Look, Michigan has been pushing this since at least 2012. They were upset with a Enbridge rupture of a pipeline at Kalamazoo. It did affect the water, and the company was less than enthusiastic about delivery. It ultimately it did. It cleaned the whole thing up, but it left a bitter taste in the mouth of everyone down there, and of course allowed environmentalists to jump all over it. The Line 5 has nothing to do with this particular line. It brings Alberta oil all the way to Ontario, as I mentioned, but it has to go through Michigan, and through Michigan, of course, it crosses the Strait of Mackinac, a 4-3 mile section. They've never had an incident there. There's never been a leak under there, but if there ever was, there is concern about contamination for obvious reasons. And so that's why the state governor on November 13th said it's all closed down in 6 months, pack up and leave, we're shutting it down. Enbridge is saying, nuts, we're not going to do that. But we'll see what happens. It's 50-50.
Well, I was going to say, negotiations, surely they can't do this to us. They must.
Well, they'd be doing it to themselves, too. A lot of the propane goes to Michigan, three refineries, one in Detroit, two in Ohio would also be affected.
Would they also have to ration as we would? If
they would, but the Americans have been able to build out pipelines, so they can, they can recommit and renominate and turn these things around. We're not as nimble here in Canada. Unfortunately, we have a line that's sitting right there. It's called the Main Line, Trans-Canada, the same part that was going to be the first section of the Energy East, but we killed that, and I think maybe it's time for the federal Liberals to wake up, smell the coffee, and realize at least a pipeline that exists would be an alternative. Because if they don't shut it down now, make no mistake, they and the forces behind it, lawfare, eco-organizations, I refer to them as eco-vandals, will have that pipeline shut down sooner or later, and now's the time to get a collective sense of what we need to do in terms of priorities and make sure that we have a Canadian alternative, a pipeline within Canada to protect Canadians.
And the supply from Montreal, which you say the capital region gets, that's not enough to meet the demand.
No, they'll get stuff in by ship, but when you're basically calling on Europeans and Americans to provide you extra oil and refined product, that's where the price goes up. So it does create a bit of an issue, and if there's around the world, we're seeing fewer and fewer refineries. Demand has, COVID has taken victims. There's two victims I can think of. Pennsylvania, the largest eastern coast refinery next to Irving, shut down 2 years ago. And the one I helped save, the Come By Chance refinery, gone, history, toast. That's 500,000 barrels a day. So it means that if we are going to import, and you can do that, you can, you know, you're going to pay a premium price. So that's where the 90 cent a liter scenario, $2 a liter scenario comes in. I hope this doesn't come to pass, but as someone who's been pushing this for the past 4 or 5 years to get people to wake up and smell the coffee, I've used that expression before, but that's exactly how I feel this morning.
Yeah.
It's a little too late. And, I think we need a longer term plan. It's nice to talk about energy and green, great resets and these things, but, when it comes down to it, it's people's bottom line, their ability to get to work and their economy to function. That's critical. It's not just oil and gas here. We're talking the petrochemical sector.
Yeah.
We're talking about everything that makes our economy run, including the ships and trucks and, of course, rail that will be needed to drive this economy.
Now, rations, I go back to the 70s. Is that right, when we saw it in the States?
We saw it, yes, of course.
You know, when I lived it in Mexico, I lived in Mexico a couple of years ago, and they had a problem with thieves attacking the gas pipeline.
Pemex, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, Pemex. And we had rations, and it was the most nerve-wracking thing to sort of say, I can only go to the grocery store in the town 45 minutes away once this week because I got to watch how much gas I have in there.
Yeah.
I remember being picked up at the airport and taken, you know, to where the destination, and we didn't have a full tank. And I said, are we going to make it? He said, oh, I have no doubt there will be a gas station between here and there. We barely made it. And, you know, the worst case scenario, you're on the side of the road in the middle of the night in Mexico. What's worse than that in our dreams or nightmares, right?
Well, a big time.
But we do not realize what the corner gas station means to our day-to-day lives.
It still does, and it still will. And, of course, with Mexico and Venezuela no longer selling oil to the United States, guess what? Canada's the only alternative. But, again, we're blocking pipelines. I don't know how to explain this any more, you know, openly. Western Canada gets it, including those in British Columbia today paying $1.52 for a liter of gasoline.
Yeah.
That's regular, by the way, in Vancouver. But Eastern Canada has been relatively immune, and we can, you know, we've taken all these things for granted.
We do
take that for granted no longer.
Yeah, I can tell you, if you have to live it for a couple of months, it becomes life changing for the wrong reasons. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Consider ourselves warned. Dan McTague, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy. In the meantime, we'll pay the higher prices while we can, because one day it may be rationed. All right, 10:50. We'll take a quick break. News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is News Talk.
If you vaccinate the most vulnerable first, you're going to see tremendous results in terms of, well, fewer people going into hospital, fewer deaths, most importantly, and less of a strain on our healthcare system. The new numbers are out specifically when it comes to long-term care homes in this province. COVID-19 mortality was reduced by 99% long-term care residents with the rollout of the vaccine. Let's bring in Dr. Paula Roshan to get more on the numbers and what does it all mean. Geriatrician, Vice President of Research at the Women's College Hospital in Toronto. Thank you for your time, Doctor. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be here today.
I can only imagine what the last year has been like, given your specialty in this province, watching your patient base hit harder than anywhere else, it seems.
I think it's been really, really tough. I mean, it's a year now from the start of this pandemic, and there hasn't been a lot of good news about what's been happening in long-term care for older people. And so I think the news that we're able to bring forward today is really good news about the benefit of the vaccine.
And I'm not going to take anything away from that, because we were hoping, and it's being confirmed, this is what's going to be the result of doing it right. But it certainly took us, as you noted, a year now, it took us long enough to get here.
It has taken a long time to get here, but I think the results that we're seeing are so, so encouraging. You know, the rollout of the vaccine now in the long-term care homes and the early findings that we're able to talk about has just had such an impact on reducing, you know, the COVID-19 infections. And this in turn leads to reductions in hospitalizations and deaths. We estimate that based on the work that we've done, that, you know, the rollout of the vaccine has already prevented what we think is more than 2,600 infections in long-term care homes. So this is very, very good news for people in long-term care.
And hundreds of deaths, I understand, prevented as well.
Yes, hospitalizations and deaths as well.
That being said, if I am listening right now and my family member was in one of these homes and they didn't make it, I would probably be frustrated and probably even more angry than I already was.
Yes, it's a very, very difficult situation. And I think that's why it's so important, you know, that this vaccine get rolled out. And clearly we've done this in long-term care, which has been the group where it's been the most difficult. But it's very important that we now get this vaccine out to the broader older population.
Yes. Yeah, who feel that they may be penalized because they're independent, living on their own, and saying, wait a minute, I'm not a burden on healthcare. I am clearly doing what I want to be, you know, but they're also isolated right now longer and probably more protecting themselves than anyone else as a result.
Yes, it's been very difficult on that group. And, you know, long-term care is an incredibly important group, and it's important that we focus there. But the vast majority of older people are living in the community. They're living in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very important that we get the vaccine out to that group so that we can have an impact there as well.
I'm curious, as a geriatrician, how do you define senior citizen today? Can you put a number on it?
Oh, that's such a difficult question to ask. You know, people use different numbers. I think in our society, we often think about the age of 65, but with life expectancy so much older right now, I don't know that that number is really the number that we want to use.
Well, but especially when it also dictates how we as a society roll out social programs. Most importantly, tell them it's time to retire now. And many people at 65, they're not ready to retire.
No, I think what you said is so, so true.
Yeah.
The vast majority of people who are in that older age group are very healthy. They're living very active, very vibrant lives, and they certainly want to stay that way. And we need to do everything we can to promote their ability to age very well in the community.
Not to go back to the tragedy through the healthcare system in as it relates specifically to long-term care and retirement homes with the most vulnerable and the numbers that speak for themselves through the pandemic. I have this bigger question, and maybe as a geriatrician, this is your specialty, you can answer it. At what point did society decide it was okay to put the seniors out to pasture?
Well, I think, you know, we need to really, you know, part of what this pandemic has made clear is we really need to rethink, you know, aging and how we care for people and how we make it so that people can age well in the community. I think that's something that we have not done well.
Doesn't it start with the family?
I think it starts everywhere. And I think one thing that always mystifies me is, you know, people always think that this aging is something that happens to somebody else. But
yeah.
Aging is something that happens to every single one of us. So it impacts us directly as well as all of the people around us. So I think we all have a vested interest to make sure that we create a society that promotes ability for everyone to age well.
You know, I was lucky enough to go to Bali, and I came across a family compound. It was, you know, a nice plot of land, but not very wealthy family. They had tons of huts, and I went in there, and the nicest hut was reserved for the eldest members of the family. And I'm thinking, there's a lesson here for all of us in North America, is there not?
Oh, I think there very much is. I mean, it's the idea about, you know, some of that intergenerational type living, which is, you know, so important for everyone in the
yeah.
family. And it's incorporating people of all ages into society. You know, and many other people provide care for older people, not in large institutions, but in smaller home-type settings. And where possible, I think that's the kind of thing we want to emulate here.
Well, if the conversation surrounding the pandemic and the elderly, if we can use that term, if it sparks nothing more than just a possible conversation that leads to change, at least we can say at the other side, you know, it wasn't all in vain, right?
I think one thing about COVID is it's made us all, you know, realize the importance of thinking about how do we think about aging in our society and how do we provide care in a way that reflects the way it should be done. So
yeah.
I hope this will lead to many improvements to come.
My fear is we have short memories. That seems to be part of the issue as well today. On that note, I always appreciate getting insights from someone who is so close to, you know, the issue, like you as a geriatrician. Dr. Paula Rochon, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
It's 11:01. Let's break for news. News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Well, here's a headline that'll stop you in your tracks. COVID-19 pill shows promise in preliminary testing. A pill? Does this mean no vaccination? When would this be used? I mean, so many questions. Let's try and get some answers. More importantly, what the results show of this preliminary study. The guy to turn to always, Dan Riskin, CTV Science and Technology Specialist. Good Monday morning to you, Dan.
And a good Monday morning to you, too. How are you?
I am well. Actually, I want to get, there's some breaking news coming from the Centers for Disease Control. I want to get your reaction to, because it is quite something here, as I just open up my phone and read it to you. It is coming from the AP, Associated Press. Centers for Disease Control says vaccinated people can gather with those at low risk for virus without masks.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
Indoors.
That's coming from the UN, from the CDC? Who's that from?
Yeah, CDC has just, Centers for Disease Control, just put new guidelines out, and that is the takeaway. Bottom line here, vaccinated people can meet indoors without masks.
Wow. Well, we'll see if Canada follows suit, but I've had a lot of questions myself. My mom has had her vaccination. She's had both shots, and I've got these kids that are still going back and forth to school, and I've still kept them apart because I'm just not totally clear on what the risks are and what the guidelines are. So this will be the conversation, I guess, is now how do we start to ease safely back into some kind of normalcy? But what an exciting press release to hear, and I look forward to seeing more about it and hearing the discussion of the smart people to see what they all think of this this guideline.
It's just breaking, but they should cover their face in public as a precaution. In other words, even though you know you go about your day, there could be others who aren't, you know, vaccinated. Therefore, even if you are and you feel comfortable with others who you know who are, it's even in public, you should continue to wear masks. Thank goodness for that part.
Yeah, I mean, well, so the big unanswered question is, if you're vaccinated, can you still carry the virus from one infected person to another? Can you still be the monkey from Outbreak that's getting everybody sick? And so if you have a bunch of people who are all vaccinated, then I suppose the logic would be that if you were to bring that virus into the room, there would be a very small chance that it could hurt anybody that's in there, since they all have these vaccines with efficacy against it. But if you were to go into a room where not everyone is vaccinated, then you could be bringing the virus to someone who is not protected. And we still don't know whether vaccinated people carry it or to what degree they carry it. But this is exciting. And of course, the real end game here is that so many people are vaccinated that the virus numbers really drop. And then there's just such a small probability that anybody's bringing it into the room in the first place, that then we really start to ease up and relax a little bit. We're certainly not there yet, but this is you know, it's just another light. We keep saying this, but it's another light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah. I mean, we're hearing here in Canada in the last couple of days that we could, in Ontario specifically, all be vaccinated with our first shot by Canada Day. I mean, to be able to put a date on it like that, I think that's going to get us through the next couple of months. This is the hardest part for us because we see the light at the end of the tunnel, but we also see some of the, well, how would I describe what's happening in Texas today? They're reopening completely, no masking, business as usual.
Yeah, the sort of cold part of me calls it a control group, right? I mean, we do all these things to try to prevent the spread, and it can be tough when you don't know what effect those things have. And from an experimental perspective, we're going to be able to see what happens when you don't put controls in place. And, you know, everybody knows what the data are going to show. When you don't take precautions, the disease spreads more, and more people get sick and more people die. So it's unfortunate to see, but different cultures, different people, different decisions, and there's no one right answer. So what works for one community might not work in another, and it's quite possible that in a place like Texas, the culture is such that if you really did just put the brakes on completely, people just would not buy in, and you'd have a complete revolt against all the rules. And so you're dealing with a different culture with different social mores, so to speak. So it's never easy.
You know, for me, I don't mind wearing a mask even if I know I'm vaccinated and others are as well. You know, tell me when to take it off in the next couple of years. I'm cool with it. But I can only imagine what a statement it makes tomorrow in Texas for those who are wearing masks and those who don't. What that can do to a community.
Yeah, it's really, it's so, I mean, it's interesting is one word for it, and yeah. heartbreaking is another one, because you think about vulnerable people in those communities, and it's easy to get crass and say, oh, you know, I hear this person interviewed in Florida, and it makes me just so mad, and I don't have a lot of sympathy for them. But the neighbor of them that didn't get interviewed is a sitting duck, and then they're you know, we're all communities that are doing this together, and so our decisions affect the people around us. And so I have a lot of sympathy for people in Texas who are made vulnerable by these kinds of decisions.
Well, and here we are marking 1 year in Canada since we first had COVID and it became, a daily issue for us. You know science inside and out. We need to just pause here and just say how remarkable it's been, even though we've been, you know, complaining about being left behind in vaccine rollouts and deliveries and so on. But that doesn't take any away from those on the front lines in science who've come up with things like vaccines.
Yeah. You're not kidding. And, you know, I believe that it's 1 year today that the first Canadian died of COVID-19 in BC at a long-term care facility. So it really is 1 year. I mean, if you want to mark it by that, it's been 1 year today. And look where we are.
Let's talk about COVID-19 pill. It shows promise in preliminary testing. When the word preliminary jumps out at me, I mean, we could be all, you know, vaccinated by the time this actually becomes an option, right?
Yeah, but it's vaccines are only good if you get them a month before you're infected, right? So if a person gets COVID-19, you can't vaccinate them then. It's too late. Their immune system's already fighting the spike protein, so there's no point in introducing the spike protein. This is a pill. It's called molnupiravir, it's in phase 2 trials that it's done well. So phase 1, of course, is where you just give it to healthy people and make sure nobody dies or gets sick from that. That's past that. Phase 2, small sample of people in the hundreds. This is 182 people. And basically, they gave it to people who had COVID but didn't have severe COVID yet. And half took this drug and half took a placebo. And then they looked to see how many of them got very sick or how many of them still had the virus. And what they found was that the people who got the drug, 5 days of the drug, when they were tested later, they did not have any of the virus left that they were giving off. So the PCR results were negative. They were no longer infectious. Whereas in the control group, a quarter of people were still sick with the virus and were still spreading it. And so this would be a pill potentially that you would take when you got COVID-19 that would stop the virus from replicating in your body, thereby making you not get very sick and also making you not infectious. So it would be a huge game changer, something we could have used a couple months ago, yeah. But it's never too late for something like this. And, you know, it's only phase 2. So we'll see. Phase 3 is where they give it to whole, you know, lots and lots of people and see if it really works across different communities or whether there's some exceptions to the rule, whether it works on different strains, et cetera.
So is this like Tamiflu that, you know, if you've got it, you take it and you have fewer sense?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's been the missing thing, is that people who get COVID have been sort of sitting ducks. We've made all kinds of progress on vaccines, but we've really not got a very good arsenal. I mean, people survive much better in hospitals because we know better how to treat them. But fundamentally, we're still rolling the dice. A person gets COVID, and whether they get severe COVID or not is really just luck. It's an unfair odds game, because if people have underlying conditions or if they're older, they're more likely to get it. But we don't know who's going to get it and who isn't. And we don't have great tools to treat it. So this would be a welcome piece of medical technology for sure.
Remember when we used to talk about the twindemic? We were so worried about the flu. Well, apparently, we haven't even started a flu season this year. That's not a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it turns out social distancing really works on the flu. And but give COVID credit. I mean, it's a disease. And we've been COVID, in spite of things that are behaviors that are strong enough to put the flu, to stop it in its tracks, COVID continues to spread in Canada. So it really speaks to how dangerous this virus is and how contagious it is.
Well, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel, we're hearing, you know, the doctors here locally, Dan, are saying things like July, we could, you know, see the return of backyard barbecues, albeit with a mask and so on, but the ability to maybe hug our grandparents again.
Oh, can you imagine?
Yeah.
It really is. It really is. And, you know, that hugging grandparents really speaks to one big part of this entire pandemic, which has been the psychological piece. I mean, there are people who have literally got post-traumatic stress disorder because they've had COVID-19 or because they've lost someone they love to COVID-19, or even just from the shutdown, perhaps having their business, close because because of the shutdowns. And so people have really, really suffered. And I think that one of the long-term questions about this, after we get the virus under control, is how we deal with the emotional fallout and the psychological fallout, the mental health fallout for all these people who have been through this together. And so I think that's going to be a big point that this summer and going forward, those hugs are really going to make a big difference.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate your time and your insights.
Yeah, take care. Thank you.
You too. Dan Riskin, CTV Science and Tech Specialist. Graham Richardson will join me on the other side. Lots to talk about with him next. News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
All right, time to get a reality check and perspective on the COVID news of the day, and there's lots of it this morning. Let's bring in senior anchor here at CTV Ottawa. Of course, the one and only, Graham Richardson. Good morning.
How are you, Leslie?
I am well. What is the biggest development since the last time we spoke?
I think today, this morning, the science table saying the vaccines are working and essentially eliminating death in long-term care.
To the tune of 99% or something.
99%. Yeah, so this is on the ground, local proof, and Ottawa has similar numbers, that vaccines are eliminating death amongst the most vulnerable. And when it gets out into the wider population, COVID will be over as a pandemic. It's very, very significant. And because the people putting out the data are very cautious scientists, and the other side of the equation are public health officers, they are being very restrained in what they're saying about it. Because as soon as they say, we are getting the upper hand, people are going to invite Nana over for a barbecue before they should. And so that's what they're trying to avoid. That's the balance of public health. But you cannot argue, like, Leslie, if they had reduced death by 85-80%, that would be a smashing success.
Huge.
This is tremendous.
Well, I can't imagine what it's like to be a family member of someone we lost in one of these long-term care. Just because the vaccine wasn't here fast enough.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
It's as simple as that.
It's as simple as that, and it speaks to the urgency, the speed with which the vaccines did get here. I'm just reminded of the waves of death. You know, we've talked about this before, like just down the road, a home in Orleans, there were like 50 deaths.
I know.
In Starwood, in Nepean, there were like 26, 27 deaths in one building. That would be an international news story in any other year.
Mm-hmm.
Basically wiping out a portion of an old age home, you know, in that kind of a scale. And it was happening all over the province, right? So that's been eliminated in wave two. It's incredible.
The other half of the story, aside from the vaccines not getting here soon enough, is how we didn't protect our most vulnerable in those homes to the best of our ability. I'd like to think it was because we didn't know what was coming, but you would think we would be there just in case, ready to go and protect them. But just how some of the dumb decisions that were made and put those people at risk, like putting them in the same room.
I've learned that it's not that complicated.
Right.
And you look at the deaths and you say, well, there was nothing we could do. Actually, yes, there was. There were things you could do. And I point to Kingston again.
Mm-hmm.
Kingston did things for old age homes that that perhaps was easier there because it's a smaller community, but they seemed ready. Like, why wasn't the province as a whole ready? And at first I was like, well, you've got these homes from the 1930s where there are ward rooms and there's four to a room. How do you fix that in a 30-day turnaround or a two-week turnaround? I appreciate that. That's a huge challenge, but I also know that, you know, like, just not fixing that problem as the second wave came on was not
inexcusable.
Yeah. And there will be ramifications for that going forward.
Why isn't there a full public inquiry being planned? I mean, it's a commission.
Well,
right?
You know why? I think because if you see the testimony that we're seeing, it's very, very damaging.
Right.
It's revealing what the public health officer knew and how he approached things, Dr. David Williams. The minister in charge, Marilee Fullerton, what she had to say, what the health minister had to say. So they didn't want more of that. They said at the time it was, we're too focused on the pandemic. That commission lawyer, Callahan, is not Callahan, I believe. I don't know him. He's a lawyer, and his job is to drill down hard questions where they cannot skirt them. And it's very damaging because all he cares about is what happened here.
I'll never forget Walkerton, the drinking water scandal, how that was the beginning of the end. I mean, this could be the beginning of the end for the current government, couldn't it be?
It could be very, very damaging. It's changed everything, right? Like, why isn't Justin Trudeau facing more criticism for procurement? Why are his numbers continuing to go up? Because basically the public says, I don't care, just get me a shot. Right. And if you get me a shot, you know, I'm not going to change the team. Similarly for Ford, every single day he was out there, and I believe he was absolutely consumed with trying to keep this thing at bay. Mm-hmm. And he had varying degrees of success. The question politically will be, and it's less important than the actual pandemic, but the question politically will be, does he pay a price politically because Ontario has not fared as well as other provinces?
Well, here's the other option too, or the other issue, is that there is no opposition, be it federally or provincially right now. The numbers of the Liberal Party provincially, even the NDP, isn't doing what it, you know, what you think it would be in a time like this. And federally, Mr. O'Toole is now lower, you know, polling lower than Andrew Scheer. And in fact, if an election were held today, they would have worse election results than Andrew Scheer did.
Hardest job in Canadian politics.
Opposition leader.
Yeah. Hardest job.
Especially when you have internal battles.
You've got internal battles, and that party is impatient. You know, that's the party that threw out John Tory as leader. And John Tory was an urban Toronto person who is now a successful mayor of Toronto. What if he was allowed to fail as leader? That's the thing. Like Aaron O'Toole, like most leaders, like people forget. Jean Chrétien in the early 90s had a challenge to his leadership when he took over.
Yeah.
He was not viewed as the savior of the Liberal Party. So most leaders, with the exception of Justin Trudeau, I always say, you got to lose as a leader first. Justin Trudeau didn't for a variety of reasons, but you got to lose and you got to allow them to lose. And if I have a criticism of the Conservative Party, particularly provincially, they are an impatient lot that does like to fight a lot. And I think Aaron O'Toole is seeing that. Mm-hmm. And he should be given a chance to fail, to build his brand with the public, to get the allow them to know him. But even some conservatives I know in my family are like, geez, he's doing really bad. I don't know if this is the guy.
Well, there's nowhere else to go, right? Well, so, I mean,
like, you can't just keep changing leaders.
Well, exactly. And who's in waiting, really? I mean,
right.
Polyev said he wasn't interested last year or whatever.
Well,
it
and he just became leader.
Exactly.
Doesn't he get some grace here?
Yeah.
You know, like, I've met him a few times. I don't know him well.
Yeah.
But I don't think throwing out the leader every time things go south is necessarily the best strategy to defeating the Liberal Party.
His CV certainly stands up.
Yeah.
And it's maybe the strategy and branding.
French well, he's getting better at that, but, you know, and they've got, as you know, they've got major work to do in Quebec. Look, they're down in Quebec. They're down in Ontario. They're down in BC.
I know.
There's no path to victory. There's no
path. Race.
Yeah.
Andrew Scheer won by 7% of the vote when he was out, when he ran in federally and in BC. Yeah. They're now, three parties are neck and neck. That tells you a lot right there in BC. Finally, the CDC, this is big. Vaccinated people can gather with those at low risk for virus without masks, but should cover face in public.
Big.
Big.
So if everybody gets a vaccine, or if you're in a group, let's say your family has all been vaccinated and it's June, they're now telling us that we can mix if they are low risk and take masks off. It's a cautious, it's an obvious thing.
Yeah.
The studies in Israel and Scotland are already saying that the protection level with these vaccines, that the science is pointing to going maskless once the majority of people are vaccinated. So, this is the rounding of the corner that Trump promised way too early. It's actually happening because of the vaccination level. And, I think Canadians and Ontarians will, are so cautious and so beaten down by bad news. They don't realize how close we are. And we're very close.
The July 1st barbecue with the family is a go.
It's a possibility, yes.
Canada Day celebrations, no, but...
I don't think so because if yeah, because
large crowds.
Because it's a large crowd and that would be a big jump up. But a month later, like, when are we... We're going to start looking at when does the border open and what does that mean for international travel?
Yeah.
Like, this is... And then let's get going with the recovery. I remind everybody, the provincial government in this budget has a 20% tax credit, a refund for people who visit locally. and that money has been budgeted on the line. So are they going to get that going in the fall, or are they going to get that going August 1st? That is money to spend that small business needs, that, and they want to. At what point, Leslie, do we get to the situation where the provincial government is not running ads about people dying in hospital because of a social gathering, and it's time to move around the province again and go to Stratford and go to the Shaw Festival or go to come to the capital? At what point?
Bring them on.
I don't know what point. My bet is midsummer. My bet is midsummer. They might push it until fall and say, you know, come see the colors, but we are certainly in that area of conversation.
The fact that we're actually having this conversation,
it's really encouraging.
It's great to see. Yeah. Thank you, Graham. Appreciate
it. All right. Thanks, Leslie.
Graham Richardson, of course, senior anchor here at chief anchor. Senior makes it sound like you're 90. Suddenly, you're Lloyd Robertson. Well, you kind of are. All right. Graham Richardson. We'll take a break for news. News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
You know, as we celebrate the rollout of vaccines and the numbers that show just how effective they are, and we worry about the variants, we got to remind ourselves there's a whole lot about the long-term effects of COVID vaccine we still don't know, especially when it comes to people over 80 who really haven't been able to participate in the vaccine research before it was all released. Well, that's going to change. Thanks to a group of researchers here in Ottawa, they're going to find out what the long-term impact of COVID vaccine is on the elderly, those who work in long-term care homes, months, even years after they get their first shot. This also is the effect on the immune system. One of those researchers, Dr. Amy Sushi, is investigator, chair in primary healthcare dementia research at the great Brière Research Institute in our city. Good morning. Thanks for your time, doctor.
Thank you for having me on the program.
I appreciate your time and, more importantly, the work you're going to do. What is the goal of this? What do you hope to find out, especially for the elderly population?
As you mentioned in your introduction, Leslie, I think it's really important for us to continue to monitor the effectiveness of vaccines in these populations, especially because, you know, even though the clinical trials have produced really promising results demonstrating that these vaccines are safe and effective, now, naturally, you have to observe people over time to understand and observe, you know, what are some of the longer-term outcomes and whether or not this continues to be a sustained level of protection against COVID-19 down the line. So that's what we're hoping to find out, and we're hoping to provide this information directly back to the long-term care homes who are participating with us in the study so they can use this information right away in their work.
And how would that affect the way they do things, potentially?
Yeah, I think it's really important to think about, you know, I think there's some ongoing discussion about whether or not in the older adult population, you know, because they're older, you know, there is a concept of immunosenescence where they're not generating as much antibody, right, even from a highly effective vaccine. So there is some discussion about, okay, well, do they need an additional booster shot beyond the two doses, you know, maybe 6 or 8 months down the line? And results from our study will be able to give them this information and to inform whether or not this potentially might be a seasonal vaccination that we have to give to this population.
Huh. Oh, that makes perfect sense on why you would do this. But you're also doing employees who work in the long-term care homes. Why is that happening?
That's right. Yeah. And one of the reasons is because, you know, we know that employees are really at the highest risk of being exposed to the COVID virus, the COVID-19 virus, because they're interacting in their community where there's high prevalence of community transmission. And, you know, they're protecting a vulnerable population in their workplace. So it's really important to understand whether or not if they've been vaccinated, or maybe perhaps if they had been affected with COVID before, does that immunity now offer some protection to not only, you know, the vulnerable population they're providing care to, but also their family members, their household members? So I think for a lot of workers, they're interested in learning about their own immunity to know whether the vaccine is working in them or not.
Let's talk about the group that you're doing. Thousands of people, both residents and staff. Have you found them yet? How does that work?
Yeah, that's the biggest challenge.
Yeah.
I think we've started recruiting in Ontario, and we are starting to roll out recruitment in British Columbia and Quebec. And in Ontario, we've actually found a lot of success. And one of the reasons is because I think the long-term care homes are looking for this information to support the care that they provide to the residents in this environment. Mm-hmm. But also tons of workers, as I mentioned, are interested in having this personalized information for themselves. So the recruitment actually hasn't been as much of a challenge as I had anticipated, because we've had a lot of great enthusiasm around this project.
Well, anything we can do to help those in long-term care, those who work there, of course, the residents who are there, this would be an important development going forward. Dr. Sue, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me again.
It's the great work of the researchers, of course, at the Breer Research Institute. That was Dr. Sue, investigator, chair, primary healthcare dementia research.